session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, reel 5. Mm. So in that early stages, prior to soloing, you were instructed in a sequence of events. What did that include? You'd mentioned, obviously, taking off, landing, straight and level flight, and turns. Was there anything else at that stage that you had to learn?
Yeah, well, the unexpected happenings, spinning, and airmanship generally, flying from A to B, the best routes, eventually cross country, the airmanship involved in knowing whether it is applicable and permissible to land at a strange airfield, and what we call precautionary approaches, not just the ordinary sort of normal angled approach, that kind of thing.
Can we go back to spinning? Because obviously, yeah, as a non-flyer, spinning looks terrifying. Could you describe, A, what spinning is, and how you would get out of a spin?
Yes. Well, it's the Tiger Moth is not an easy aircraft to get into a spin. Other aircraft, for instance, the Magister is much easier and sometimes too easy to get into a spin if you find that you're not doing the correct thing. But the Tiger Moth, and under instruction, you would sit in the back seat, the instructor in the front, and he would reduce the airspeed by reducing the travel of the control, engine control, and bring the aircraft up into quite a steep upward angle. And you would find the Tiger Moth slowly beginning to sink in this strange position where you look as if you were going up at quite a steep angle. In fact, you're beginning to drop as, without control, no control yet. You're not going to go left, you're not going to go right. The aircraft as a whole is virtually stalled. And stalling speed is the speed at which an aircraft can no longer remain in the air. That seems to go on for some time when you're a pupil pilot. And you wonder what's going to happen next, and suddenly the instructor will kick one way or the other on the rudder, and the whole thing seems to be coming to pieces. It just flops over to the left and stays turning to the left as it descends. So you're beginning to fall like a leaf being twirled round and round. The ground seems to be coming up at you, moving in a circle all the way around you. And you wonder what's going to happen next. But the aircraft stops the gyrating. And you then find that you're in a steep dive, which you come out of in the normal way by gently easing back the stick and at the appropriate point applying the power. Now that coming out of the spin as meant that the instructor, and when you have to do it solo, you have to do it yourself, of course, has first of all applied the opposite rudder to stop the, say you're spinning to the left, he would apply the opposite rudder to stop the that circular movement. Then, if necessary, get the nose down into the dive that is necessary in order to be able to pull out of it. You would then, because by these maneuvers, you've applied or made it possible for more pressure to be placed on the rudder, because you put it into a dive, the tailplane will be in the down position, which exposes more of the rudder surface. So that helps in order to bring it into the dive, which has followed, stopping the gyration. And then it's a matter of pulling it out of the dive, well, as appropriate. Depends on your height, of course. I mean, if you're too close to the ground, you do that fairly quickly and apply some power. It's quite a gentle experience when you stop spinning. But most people are, and I was, affected by the rotation because in order to impress it on the pupil, I think the spin as such is generally allowed to go on longer than it would do if you, and when you were the pilot, you might decide that three or four rotations was enough, thank you very much. But the instructor is impressing on the pupil that. And this is a dangerous thing to be in. And of course, you also got to remember that whereas the Tiger Moth is an easy aircraft to control in these unusual situations, there are many aircraft which are not. And therefore, the unfortunate effects of a spin really have to be understood as soon as possible by the trainee pilot, so that he will say to himself in a different aircraft, one which may not have the gentle characteristics of a Tiger Moth, he'll say to himself, I'd better do this at 6,000 feet rather than the 3,000 feet you could get away with in the Tiger Moth.
How much dual instruction were you given with the instructor, roughly, before you soloed?
The average, and I was one of the average, 8 hours over these various aspects of what you needed before you could go solo.
And a little bit about your instructor. Did you have the same instructor for that initial period prior to soloing?
Yes.
Who was he? Was he a regular, was he an officer or an NCO?
Well, they varied. In fact, as we were the first war course at Fair Oaks, for the first part, up to 1st of January 1940, the instructors were still in civilian clothes. And they had all, well, if I say all, I'll come back to that in a minute. They had been part of the Fair Oaks Reserve Flying School. They had been in the RAF, and when we came back after leave, in early January, we had quite a surprise because they were all in RAF RAF rank, usually in the rank of flying officer. But in addition to those ex-RAF people, shall we say, there was a sergeant pilot. There were two sergeant pilots who were regulars, a flying officer who was the RAF test officer. The CO, squadron leader Arthur, I think he was responsible for training a total of 7,000 pilots in his career. I think I'm correct. I've got the figure somewhere. He was the CO, had been the CO of the reserve flying school and continued in that post.
In the aircraft, how did you communicate with your instructor?
Oh, the old tube mouthpiece. The only sound that came through was what you put in. I mean, it wasn't amplified, or you just had on a flying helmet, of course, with the two tubes, and that's the way the voice travelled from one to the other. So sometimes it was necessary to, shout.
You said that you sort of took the average time prior to soloing. How easy did you take to that initial training with a dual instruction and instructor? Did you find it easy, or was it difficult? Was there anything that was a problem, or did you find it relatively straightforward?
Yes, it's surprising, really, when you look back. Excuse me. In each of the cases where I, and I'm quite sure others, had to become used to a different environment, both in the aircraft and in the social circumstances, if you can put it, how it just happened. There wasn't really much thought about that. Whether it was... I don't remember anybody saying it was difficult. We didn't lose anybody on that particular course, apart from one pilot. And it's rather strange, because he was an absolute whiz kid, as we would say these days, in things like aerobatics on the Tiger Moth. He just sort of seemed to be a natural. But yet he didn't get through because of failures in other aspects of the course. We did understand that he was going to be part of the next course, and we just hoped that he would get through, because if ever there was a fighter pilot with all the tricks, he soon showed that. I found that you were mentioning a relationship perhaps between the pupil and the pilot. I found that my instructor, who was a fairly, what I thought then, older, perhaps he was in his 40s, something like that, he wasn't awfully fond of doing the aerobatics, looping the loop, or rolling, spinning, and that kind of thing. I don't think I had my fair whack of that in the actual training. Not that I regretted it, because I was, from that early stage, I was more interested in, shall we say, wider aspects of flying than just simply throwing an aircraft around the sky. He certainly didn't like spinning. There was a tenseness there which you could feel, whereas with other instructors you felt that there is a rapport immediately. It gives you so much more confidence. Anyway, we got through, and we had the navigation test. We had to land at a couple of other flying training schools. And
before we discuss that, Ted, can we talk about your soloing?
Solo,
after
yeah.
After your 8 hours of dual instruction, could you tell me about the process of soloing and obviously what you felt like when you did your first solo?
Oh, well, of course, when you've done your first solo, then that's it. You're a pilot in your own mind anyway. Well, there's a long way to go yet. There again, you were just given exercises to do, and you went off and did them.
So what would happen? Would you have been out under dual instruction and then would you be given a specific time to go and do a solo, or would it just happen?
Oh, yes, it just happens. Well, with most instructors, I suppose it varies, but certainly in my experience, most people would be... they would know they're coming up to the point where they'd have the confidence, for one thing, to go solo. And you did hear a bit of belly aching now and again, you know, I'm ready to go, but he's holding me back, sort of thing. But you would go up on perhaps a couple of circuits and bumps, or perhaps a bit of aerobatics and so on, and then come down and you said, right, off you go, do a circuit and landing. That was it. I think it's a good idea just to be told like that and say, go on, go and do it.
Is it initially strange to be in the aircraft on your own at that point, because you've been under dual instruction all that time? Is there initial feeling of, this is just me?
Well, I can't remember that. Maybe. I mean, you're just so pleased that there's nobody in the front cockpit that... you know, you hope somebody's watching you, particularly if you do a good landing. these things just seem to happen.
One thing I was going to ask you about landings, how easy is it to judge your height as you're coming in onto a grass airfield?
That's the most difficult thing, of course, on any aircraft. And that's why you need to spend quite a bit of time just sitting in the aircraft on the ground to get used to the height you are above the actual surface you're going to land on. But it's something that just comes with experience. Obviously, it's part of the necessary... talents of an aircraft, of a pilot, to be able to judge that, and it's one of those essential judgments over which you could be failed. I mean, I don't know. There were some people who made persistently heavy landings, but I don't think we had anybody who was really in danger of being thrown off the course because of that. Although I know that it did happen, that they just haven't got the knack of holding off, as it's called, holding off. You should be able, once you've mastered an aircraft, you should be able to hold off as long as you want to. In other words, you get the aircraft into a landing position with an ordinary undercarriage. That's two wheels at the front and one at the back. Obviously, it's a nose-up position because the back of the aircraft is lower than the front. So that actually is more difficult to hold off than a modern aircraft, which is a tricycle undercarriage, which has its wheel at the front, one wheel at the front, so that you are, even these 747s and obviously aircraft in between that size, they are actually coming in on the approach in a virtual landing position, and they're holding that position and sinking by the control of the power and the various helpful aids they have these days, flaps of various kinds coming up here and going down there, and that sort of thing. But with a Tiger Moth, you should be able to hold off, and virtually, it's done fairly frequently. When you think of all the flying that was being done during the war, that somebody perhaps had a success when we were bombing ships and so on, they come in and do a hold off along the runway at a height of about 3 feet off the runway, and then take off and go around and do a proper landing. That is a critical requirement, which I hadn't thought of until you mentioned it as being a possible fail point. But as I say, I don't recall anyone actually failing on the courses that I was on. It's easier to hold off an Anson, actually, than it is a Tiger Moth. But that's the hold off position, and then if you're in that position, you're okay to land. You just completely close the power, or of course nowadays put on reverse power to help stop.
After Solene, could you explain some of the things that you have mentioned, a little bit about the aerobatics and the types of manoeuvres that you would do initially, I suppose, under instruction? What were the things that you were taught at that next kind of stage?
Well, really, aerobatics are just the result of movements of the controls, obviously, and of course the use of power. If you're doing a loop, then if you are in an aircraft which hasn't got a lot of power in comparison with its lift and drag potential, then you would go into a dive with added power. In a Tiger Moth, of course, this would be necessary in order to get up sufficient speed to pull the stick back. And it's merely a matter of keeping the aircraft straight on the rudders and pulling back on the stick. And having sufficient speed to get over the top. Once you're on the top and you're on the way down, of course, then you close reduce the power, keep the aircraft straight, and you've done it. It's just a matter of having the momentum to take you over the top. I've no idea how they do all these maneuvers that you see in the Red Arrows and that kind of thing, but most of these maneuvers are basic. If you're going into a roll, then I'm told that nowadays all you do is kick the rudder and you're over. You've got the power there. You put the power on or take it off, and it makes so much difference. But when you haven't really got much power compared with the potential of the aircraft, then it does need a little more care and is more dependent on getting the right use of the controls at the right time, so that for a roll, the only thing to remember is that let's do a full roll first, then you would apply a little more power. If you're going rolling to the left, left rudder, and these are relatively heavier pressures you're putting on the control surfaces than if you're flying straight and level and so on. It's got to be, you've got to break the flight path, if you like, the way the aircraft is flying, and put it into a new form of remaining in the air, put it that way. So left rudder, left bank. When you are halfway around, then if it is necessary to take any control to, again, you're using the horizon if it's a fine day. If there's any need to, if you feel you're dropping when you're halfway around, then remember that the fin of the aircraft is in the same relationship with the Earth's surface, or with the flattened level, or whatever you want, as would be the elevators or the wings if you were the right way up, so that you can get some effect from using, strange as it may seem, the rudder to give you a little lift or a little depression at that certain point in the roll, if you're dropping your nose below the horizon, and then you come up on the other side and resume straight and level. It's a long, long time since I've done any of this, and I haven't really had any need, flying different aircraft. And so there will be people who may hear this who would say, there are other ways of doing it.
Did you do any barrel rolls as well? Is that a different form of roll?
Oh, it is different, yes. I don't know. I haven't done any barrel rolls. But I know that they need power. At least they did in that type of early trainer. They need power to bring them round. I wouldn't like to. I've made enough mistakes already, I'm sure, without adding to them.
You mentioned navigation, cross-country navigation.
Yeah.
How was that instructed? Did you go with an instructor at first? On a cross-country, or did you go?
Oh no, no! The navigation, the test, of course, was the only time we flew to other aerodromes, unless there was some emergency. That in itself was the navigation, passing the navigation section, shall we say. And navigation, of course, was taught in the classroom, basically. We were flying one day, we'd be at the lectures in the classroom the next day, so we were alternating in that way. And we'd pick up basics of navigation. We had done some already, of course, even pre-war, when we had the lectures, and also at ITW. But this was, there was a very good navigation tutor. He was regular RAF. He was one of those I should have mentioned as being in uniform from the beginning. And anyway, the normal sequences of flying to get to an area which the instructor would deem suitable for a particular exercise, maybe spinning or rolling or whatever, that would be that passage of the aircraft from the airfield to the point where he was going to carry out the exercises, would be a navigation lesson in itself. There was no time lost, I mean, in that you weren't just sort of sitting there. There'd be various things to look for, particularly which landmarks were important, the use of railway lines in the basic stations and so on, and even things flying over the sea, of course, the direction of the wind, and later, even in Coastal Command in the early years, the only way we could judge the wind, having a very simple forecast, would be to look at the wind lanes, as they're called, the way of the ripples of the sea. And even that is a possibility over land, over large water. You can get an idea of the direction of the wind. And that, of course, is one of the most important points of navigation. It's no use saying going from A to B unless you know where the wind's coming from, because that's you're in the air. And the wind is a much more powerful force than you are. And